completely gratuitous.
It's all right, I said. She didn't say anything everyone else wasn't already thinking.
It's not all right, and I will never forgive her. Neither should you.
I hoped he would change his mind, because his mother was currently our only hope of returning to Grace. Although she demonstrated her affection in strange ways, her whole world revolved around Ellis, and to a lesser degree in torturing me. Without us, her life would be a void. I was entirely sure that she was already attempting to intercede, but I'd never seen the Colonel in such a state, and I wasn't sanguine about her chances. Appealing to my own father was pointless. When I wrote to tell him that Ellis and I had eloped, I'd expected him to be upset, and wasn't surprised when he didn't respond right away. It was months before it dawned on me that he wasn't going to. I'd seen him only once since, although we lived less than 2 miles apart. He was crossing the street, and when he saw me, he pretended he hadn't and turned the other way. From overheard fragments of conversation, I gathered his activities revolved almost exclusively around the Corinthian Yacht Club, allowing him to avoid contact with the fairer sex altogether. At some point after midnight, I managed to convince Ellis that our things weren't on their way and we should just go to bed. Neither of us had so much as an overnight bag. While the room was stuffy, it was also drafty. Ellis called me a blanket hog, accusing me of repeatedly rolling away with the covers, at which point he'd grab them back and leave me exposed. After a few rounds of tug-of-war, which started out in good fun but deteriorated quickly, we ended up facing opposite directions on the edges of the bed, with neither one of us adequately covered. I lay awake, worrying. When Ellis finally fell asleep, he snored so loudly I had to hold a pillow over my head, pressing it against my ears. There was an odd smell, sort of earthy and minerally. For the rest of the night, all I could think about was how many heads had lain on those pillows before my own. We were roused by an understated yet insistent rapping at the door.
"Dear God," croaked Ellis, "what time is it?"
I peered at the radium-painted clock beside me. "Nearly 7."
"The sun's not even up," he complained.
After a few more minutes of intermittent knocking, I mumbled, "You'd better get it. They're not going away." He sighed irritably, then shouted,
"Coming!"
He switched on the lamp and rolled out of bed, yanking the chenille bedspread off as though he were doing the tablecloth trick. He wrapped it around his shoulders and stomped away, slamming the bedroom door behind him. I had a fair indication of what was going on because of the shuffles, bangs, and clunks. It went on for nearly 10 minutes. When Ellis returned, he wadded up the bedspread and tossed it onto my legs. As he flopped back into bed, I tried to straighten it. "Our things, I presume?" I asked.
"Our every worldly belonging, from the looks of it. 6 carts worth. We're going to have to turn sideways to get to the door."
I tried not to panic. The Colonel would have given the order before he retired for the night, when his anger was still fresh, but a queasy feeling settled in the pit of my stomach anyway.
"I don't suppose you have any idea where your pills might have ended up," Ellis asked.
"Would you like me to have a look?"
"Never mind," he said miserably. "It's all right."
The lamp was still on, so I went to the front room. The floor was almost entirely covered by trunks and suitcases. Emily, Pemberton, and the others must have been up all night packing. I found my cosmetics case on a low table, along with my hat boxes. To my relief, it was organized immaculately, the pill bottle tucked discreetly under its tray. Poor Emily. We'd cost her at least 2 nights' sleep, which my mother-in-law would certainly not consider an excuse if her daytime duties suffered. I handed the bottle to Ellis and sat beside him. He propped himself up on an elbow, shook 2 pills into his hand, and swallowed them dry. Then he fell back onto his pillow.
"Thank you, darling. I'm a little on edge," he said.
"I know. Me too."
"Let's try to get back to sleep. In the morning, in the real morning, I'm going to have the largest goddamn lobster in the city brought up to us, along with a mountain of potato salad. Caviar, too. They can skip the plates and just bring forks."
I made my way back to my side of the bed. When I crawled under the covers, Ellis switched off the lamp. We found ourselves much closer together than we had been before. He rolled onto his side and threw an arm across my waist.
"Well, what do you know?" he said. Maybe there are enough blankets after all.
In the early evening, the concierge called to tell us that Hank was waiting for us in the lobby bar. Ellis and I were no longer speaking, a result of my suggestion that he talk to his mother and try to pave the way for a truce. We rode the elevator in silence. The boys drank bourbon sidecars, and I ordered a gin fizz. A few drinks in, as Ellis and I took turns recounting the disastrous repercussions of the party, the freeze began to thaw. Soon we were finishing each other's sentences and apologizing with our eyes. We were in the same mess, facing the same consequences. Although I was willing to capitulate sooner, it was just a tactical difference. We were upset with our situation, not each other. I reached my foot out under the table and ran it lightly down his calf. His eyes brightened, and the edges of his mouth lifted into a smile.
"I'm still trying to wrap my head around the idea of your mother shouting," said Hank. "Are you sure it was your mother, the same Edith Stonehide I've known all these years?" "The very one. And it was more like a hooting," said Alice. "An overtaxed owl."
"A broken-down woodwind," I added. "Frail, yet screechy."
"I'd have paid good money to see that," said Hank, lighting a cigarette. "I wish I'd known," said Alice. "I'd have offered you my seat." "Do you really think the Colonel and your mother had an affair?" Hank asked, blowing a series of smoke rings.
"Of course not," I said. "My gorgon of a mother-in-law extrapolated that because at some point she caught him looking at her, which I'm sure he did. Everybody did."
"Yes, but he also defended her," Hank pointed out, "to his wife."
"So maybe he carried a little torch for her," I said, "which still means nothing because who didn't? She had that effect on people."
"Not your father," Hank continued. "I never did understand why she married him. She could have had anybody she liked. Gorgeous, pedigreed, a bank account the size of Montana. I can't imagine why she allowed herself to get hitched to an old fart like your father."
"She wasn't pedigreed," I said, throwing him a dirty look. Hank knew perfectly well that my mother had married up. Hank looked outraged.
"Of course she was pedigreed. In the Levy district."
He broke down, cackling at his own joke. I said flatly.
"No offense, darling girl. Money is its own pedigree. But back on topic, what if it's true? Maybe that's why your mother-in-law was so hell-bent against the two of you getting married. Maybe," he said, waving his cigarette in circles, "your brother and sister."
Alice and I burst into simultaneous groans of disgust. "Hank, that's not even remotely funny. Please, my mother did not have an affair with the Colonel."
"How can you be so sure?" Hank went on. "Maybe that's the reason your mother-in-law encouraged him to go monster hunting, to get him out of harm's way, so to speak."
"I'm sure she just wanted him out of the way, period," I said. "She probably packed his bags. She probably booked his passage."
"You're both forgetting that it was his idea," said Alice. "He couldn't get out of there fast enough. I'm surprised he didn't leave a kernel-shaped hole in the front door on the way out. Can hardly blame him, though."
"She is a trial," I said.
"She's worse than that," said Alice,
looking suddenly grim. Hank leaned back in his chair and cocked an eyebrow. He looked first at Alice and then at me.
"Your drinks are empty. Let me remedy that."
He snapped his fingers over his head until he got the attention of the bartender, then pointed at the glasses. Alice stared into his depleted drink, poking the ice cubes with his swizzle stick.
"So," Hank said, rubbing his hands together, "given the circumstances, I think you'll be even more pleased to hear my news. Unless you're about to tell me my father dropped dead." "I highly doubt it," Alice said without looking up.
The waiter delivered fresh drinks. Alice pulled his toward him, picked up the new swizzle stick, and went back to stabbing ice.
"Maddie, darling," Hank said expectantly.
I sighed before dutifully asking, "What news?"
"I've found this passage."
"Passage to where?" I asked in the same disinterested voice. I knew full well what he was talking about, and was trying to convey that I didn't want to play, and was quite sure that Ellis didn't either.
"You know," Hank said with a coy smile.
I went for the direct approach. "Hank, we're not in the mood right now. That's what got us into this pickle in the first place."
"Then get in the mood. We leave in 3 days."
I put my drink down and took stock of his demeanor. He was deadpan, yet clearly pleased with himself. "You're not serious," I said.
I am in absolute earnest, he replied.
But it's impossible. There are no liners running.
Connections, Maddie, connections, he said with a flourish. We're going on a Liberty ship, the SS Mallory, a freighter taking supplies. It's part of a convoy. And speaking of supplies, stock up on cigarettes and stockings, both nylon and silk. International currency, if you will.
His continued straight face began to worry me. Hank, this isn't funny.
It's not meant to be.
We can't cross the Atlantic during the war.
We'll be perfectly safe. We're going to the Highlands. That's where they send the evacuated children from the cities, for God's sake.
I turned to Alice. He'd abandoned the ice and was now pushing the ashtray back and forth. Darling, say something, I pleaded.
Don't we need papers or something, he asked. Arranged for them, too, Hank said brightly. And a 16mm Cine Kodak movie camera. After we get our footage of the monster, we'll send the reel directly to Eastman Kodak and have them develop it. Voila! Would-be naysayers won't have a nay to say. We'll make history. We'll be famous.
After a moment of silent stammering, I managed to ask, And what does Violet think about this? Violet was nothing if not sensible. She didn't even approve when we pulled entirely harmless pranks, like hiding someone's yacht in the wrong slip or turning the racket club's pool water purple. She'd sent an apology after we had General Pugh's sailboat moved around to the back of his house, even though she wasn't there when the crime was committed.
No idea. She's off doing something or other, said Hank. Rolling bandages or the like.
You haven't told her, I said in disbelief.
Not yet, said Hank, sipping his drink. I figured one day of misery was preferable to three.
She'll never agree to it.
I don't expect her to.
Hank, she's expecting you to propose. You can't just abandon her.
I will propose just as soon as we get back. Frankly, I'm getting a little worried that she's rubbing off on you. I was hoping it would work the other way around. Hank's right, said Alice,
still pushing the ashtray around.
You used to like adventures.
I do like adventures, but sailing into the war is hardly an adventure.
Then think of it as a scientific excursion, Hank said calmly. Honestly, Maddie, we'll be perfectly safe. You can't imagine I would even suggest it if I weren't completely sure of that, and Freddy certainly wouldn't have arranged it.
Freddy, I said with growing despair. What's Freddy got to do with this?
He's the one who made the arrangements, of course.
While I was trying to wrap my head around Freddy's involvement in all this, Hank looked deep into my eyes.
Maddie, darling girl, this is my last hurrah, my final bit of craziness before donning the ball and chain. And since my particular ball and chain seems intent on civilizing me, surely you wouldn't deny me this one final caper?
Why don't we come up with something that won't get us blown to pieces? And who's to say that I won't rub off on Violet after all? When the war ends, we'll force her to come with us. I'll buy a pair of hip waders and bag the monster myself. Heck, I'll buy a pair for Violet and drag her kicking and screaming into the lock with me. Won't that be a sight? Hank leaned forward and pressed two fingers against my lips.
Shh, he said. We have to do this. It's for Alice.
Alice looked suddenly up. The fire was back in his eyes.
Let's do it. Let's fucking do it. It fixes everything.
What? What does it fix? I asked.
Everything, he repeated.
I could see there was no arguing with him, at least not there, and certainly not in front of Hank. I'll have one of those cigarettes, I said, bobbing my foot under the table and glaring at the rows of glittering bottles behind the bar. In a flash, Hank had the case open and extended. I let him hold it there for a few seconds longer than was comfortable, then grabbed one. Hank leaned forward, completely cool, and flicked his lighter, a sterling silver Dunhill with a clock on its side. I sucked a few times, enough to get the thing lit, then pushed my chair back and marched toward the bank of elevators, letting my heels clack noisily on the marble. I ditched the cigarette in the first available ashtray, because I hated cigarettes, which both Hank and Alice knew. Asking for one was a statement. Alice was supposed to follow me back to our suite. Instead, he stayed in the lobby bar with Hank. I paced the room, trying to persuade myself that this was a joke, that Hank was just pulling our legs, but every instinct told me otherwise. He'd worked out too many details, and if it was a prank, he wouldn't have let it go on after he saw Alice's reaction. Unless they were in on it together, but that seemed even less plausible. They hadn't had a moment alone to plan. I just wanted everything to go back to normal, but the only way that could happen would be if we found a solution that let both the Colonel and Ellis emerge with their dignities intact. Collective amnesia would have been an option if the accusations had been limited to the drawing room, where the only witness was the canary, but they hadn't. The Colonel had been disgraced in public. The part that frightened me most, that made me think Hank really had made solid plans, was his mention of Freddy. If anyone could manage such arrangements, it was Freddy Stillman, whose father was an admiral, but it was beyond me why he'd lift a finger to help. The four of us had been close friends, a quartet instead of a trio, during one blissful summer in Bar Harbor, Maine, until I rejected his completely unexpected proposal, and probably not as sensitively as I should have. 10 days later, I eloped with Ellis, and we hadn't exchanged a word since. That was 4.5 years ago. I was surprised that Hank was still in touch with him, especially since it was rumored that Freddy had set his sights on Violet before Hank rolled through and swept her off her feet. Ellis returned hours later, entirely smashed, and confirmed my fears. This was no prank, and he was absolutely determined that we were going to go. I pointed out, as gently as I could, what I'd hoped was obvious, that it made no sense whatsoever to throw ourselves into the middle of an ocean crawling with U-boats on a quest to find a monster that probably didn't even exist, especially as a way of proving his worth to people who were too ignorant to realize he was as honorable as any of them. We knew the truth. I knew the truth. It would be difficult, but together we could withstand the scrutiny until the war ended. Ellis turned on me with such ferocity, I almost didn't recognize him. Of course there was a monster, he said. Only an idiot would think there wasn't a monster. Never mind all the sightings and photographs, including his own father's, which, by the way, were still the best of the lot. Scotland Yard itself had confirmed the beast's existence when they asked the Colonel not to harm it. Even as he continued shouting at me, waving his arms around the tiny, luggage-filled room, even as I absorbed that he had essentially called me an idiot, what really caught my attention was that he'd done a complete about-face regarding his father's pictures. I tried to process this as Ellis pointed at the wallpaper, which was curling at the corners, at the water stains on the ceiling, as he wiped his finger along the windowsill and then held it up so I could inspect the crime. I wondered if he'd believed his father all along, and, if so, why he'd made such a terrible accusation the night before. Never mind the things he'd said as we left the party. I hadn't uttered a word since my initial plea, but he continued his tirade as though I were arguing with him. Did I really want to live in this dump, sitting around like hostages, waiting to see if the Colonel was going to cut off his allowance completely? And what if he did? What then? Did I think it was all right to act like Scott Lyons, running tabs up to the hilt and then skipping out, moving from hotel to hotel? Because he certainly didn't. We were going to Scotland. It was our only option, and we would not set foot on this continent again until he had found the monster the Colonel had faked. He stopped, red and sweaty, huffing and puffing, and waiting for me to challenge him. But my brain was stuck on the fact that he'd flip-flopped on the subject of his father yet again, and all in a matter of seconds. I had witnessed firsthand how badly society treated Ellis, particularly his own father, and was well aware of the toll it was taking. For 4 years, I'd stood by helplessly as the happy, confident young man I'd met in Bar Harbor eroded into the bitter, suspicious man currently raging in front of me, a man who constantly believed people were giving him dirty looks and whispering behind his back, a man who was increasingly irritated by my Pollyanna-ish platitudes because he recognized them for what they were. But because I'd watched this devolution happen in dribbles and bits, I hadn't realized until that moment that he'd already been pushed beyond his limits. What was currently at stake was his entire self-worth. Hank was right. Ellis needed this. I crossed the half-dozen feet that divided us and put my arms around him, pressing my face to his chest. After a moment of shocked hesitation, he put his arms around me, too, and a few seconds after that, I felt him relax.
"I'm so sorry, my darling. I don't know what came over me," he said.
"It's okay," I said.
"I should never have spoken to you like that. It's inexcusable. You did absolutely nothing wrong."
I understand, darling. It's okay.
Oh, God, Maddie, he said, breathing into my ear. Hank's right. They broke the mold when they made you. I can't imagine what I did to deserve you.
For a moment, as absurd as it was, I thought he might want to make love, but from his chest movements, I could tell he was starting to cry. I held him even tighter. If finding the monster was what it was going to take to make Ellis feel whole again, then so be it. I just hoped there was a monster to be found. And so, 3 days later, we sailed into the Battle of the Atlantic. Chapter 5. I saw my first rat before we set sail. Although our cabins were in the officers' quarters, there were only two, and they were tiny. So Ellis and I had to share a very small bed, a bunk, really, which would have made sleeping impossible even if the engine that powered the rudder wasn't immediately beneath us. There was a small wash basin in the cabin, but the bath facilities were shared. I was the only woman on board, so I had to wash myself at the sink. I was also so sick, I couldn't keep so much as a cracker down. When I wasn't hanging my face over the sink, trying not to throw up, I was lying on the bunk with my arms wrapped around my stomach, doing my best to stare into the distance, which in this case meant trying to focus on some point beyond the cabin wall, which was altogether too close. The day before we were supposed to land at the naval base in Scotland, German U-boats caught up with one of the other ships in the convoy and torpedoed her. We circled back to pull men out of the water, which was so slick with fuel, it was actually on fire. The Germans were still there, of course, and we could feel the depth charges, which pitched us about until I feared capsizing and splitting up in equal parts. Unsecured items flew across the room. The electricity flickered on and off, and the cabin was so full of smoke I couldn't breathe without choking. The handkerchiefs I held over my nose and mouth came away the color of lead. Ellis took pills by the handful. He'd refilled my prescription before we left, getting a great many more than usual, since he didn't know how long we were going to be away, and the quantities he consumed alarmed me. When the torpedoes came, Hank shrank into a corner with a bottle of whiskey, saying that if he was going to die, he might as well die drunk. I shrieked each time a deck gun fired. Ellis put his lifebelt on and wanted me to do the same, but I couldn't. Having something bulky strapped around my middle impeded my breathing and increased my panic. And besides, what possible difference could it make? If the ship went down, the Germans wouldn't pluck us from the water. And even if they did, the poor men the SS Mallory had managed to save were grievously burned and likely to die anyway. I flew into a tear-filled rage. I threw an alarm clock at Hank, who ducked it wordlessly and lit another cigarette. I pounded Ellis's chest and told him he had tossed us into the middle of a war because his father was a stubborn, stupid, irascible old man, and now, because of him, we were going to be killed. I said I hoped the colonel dropped dead in his House of Testoni shoes, preferably upon hearing that we had all been blown up, because he was a fraudulent, egomaniacal blowhard, without so much as a drop of compassion for anyone else on this earth, including, and especially, his own son. I declared Edith Stonehide a self-righteous, bitter old cow, and said I hoped she survived deep into a lonely old age so she could reap the rewards of her treatment of us and its fatal consequences. I told Ellis that the second we hit solid ground, I was turning around and taking the next boat out of there, although, even as I said it, I knew I would never willingly get on another ship. I told him that he was the idiot, and that his and his father's stupid obsession with a stupid monster was going to be the end of us all, and if he could come up with a stupider reason to die, I'd really like to know what that was. Ellis's non-reaction was almost more frightening than the torpedoes, because I realized that he too thought we were going to die. And then I felt guilty and cried in his arms. When we finally reached land, it was dusk. For the last couple of days, I'd been worried we might be changing ships rather than docking, because everyone kept referring to our destination as the HMS Helicon, but apparently that was a code name for the Alt Bay naval base. I was so desperate to get off the ship that I staggered on deck while the wounded were still being unloaded. Ellis followed me, but at the sight of the burned men, turned and went back below. Some of the men no longer looked human, scorched and misshapen, their flesh melted like candle wax. Their agonized moans were terrible to hear, but even more horrifying were the silent ones. One looked me in the eyes as he was carried past, his head bobbing slightly in time with the steps of the men bearing the stretcher. His face and neck were blackened, his mouth open and lipless, exposing crowded teeth that made me think of a parrotfish. I hated myself immediately for the comparison. His eyes were hazel, and his arms ended in white bandages just below the elbows. His peeling scalp was a mottled combination of purple and black, his ears so charred, I knew there was no hope of saving them. He held my gaze until I turned in shame, leaning my forehead against the salty white paint of the exterior wall. I pressed my eyes shut. If I'd had the strength to go back down to the cabin, I would have, but I didn't. Instead, I kept my eyes closed and held my hands over my ears. Although I managed to block out most sounds, I could do nothing about the vibration of footsteps on the deck. I was excruciatingly aware of each ruined life being carried past. God only knew how these men's lives would be changed, if they even survived. I tried not to think of their mothers, wives, and sweethearts. When we were finally allowed to disembark, I stumbled down the gangplank and onto the dock. My knees gave out, and if Hank hadn't been there to catch me, I'd have gone off the edge. Everything in my vision was jerking back and forth. I couldn't even tell which way was up.
"Jesus Christ, Maddie," he said. "You almost fell in the soup. Are you all right?"
"I don't know," I said. My voice was hoarse. "I feel like I'm still on the ship." Ellis took my other elbow, and together they led me off the dock. I stretched out an arm and leaned against a white-painted lamppost. The curb at my feet was also white.
"Maddie, are you okay?" said Ellis.
Before I could answer, a man in a wool greatcoat and hat approached us. He was tall and broad-shouldered, with red cheeks, black leather gloves, and an eye patch. His one eye alternated between Ellis and Hank.
"Henry Boyd?"
"That's me,"
said Hank, lighting a cigarette.
"Well, I knew it was one of you,"
the man said in a melodious accent, leaving us to interpret the wherefores.
"I'll be driving you, then. Where are your things?"
"Still on board.
The porters are back there somewhere," said Hank, waving vaguely toward the ship. The man laughed.
"I'm your driver, not your lackey."
Hank raised his eyebrows in surprise, but the man put his hands in his pockets, spun on his heels, and began to whistle. His earlobe and part of the cartilage was missing on the same side as the eye patch. A thick scar ran up his neck and disappeared beneath his ginger hair. Ellis whispered,
"I think you're supposed to tip him."
"Freddy said it was all taken care of," Hank said.
"Apparently it's not," Ellis murmured.
"Will somebody do something?" I cried. Hank cleared his throat to get the man's attention.
"I don't suppose I could make it worth your while."
"Oh, aye,"
said the man, in a firm but cheery voice.
"I wouldn't say no to a wee minding."
When our trunks and suitcases had finally been identified, collected, and loaded, a feat of engineering that resulted in an ungainly mountain of luggage strapped to the roof and trunk of the car, our driver raised his one visible eyebrow and glanced at Ellis's waist.
"I don't think you'll be needing that anymore," he said.
Ellis looked down. He was still wearing his lifebelt. He turned away, fumbling as he unfastened it, and let it drop at the base of a lamppost. I felt his shame acutely. The driver opened the rear door of the car and motioned for me to get in. A soiled blanket covered the seat.
"Slide on over, then,"
he said. He winked at me, I think. Ellis got in after me. Hank took one look at the blanket before walking to the front of the car. He stood by the passenger door, waiting for the driver to open it.
"Well, are you going to get in, aren't you?"
said the driver, jerking his chin toward the rear. Finally, reluctantly, Hank came around back. Ellis frowned and shifted to the middle seat. Hank got in beside him.
"Right, then,"
said the driver. He shut our door, climbed into the driver's seat, and resumed whistling. Chapter 6 After 4 hours and 20 minutes of utter stomach-roiling misery, with the driver leaning maliciously into hairpin curves, despite, or perhaps because of, having to stop no fewer than 6 times so I could lean out of the back of the car and be sick, he came to a stop and announced we'd reached our destination.
There we are, then,
he said cheerfully, shutting off the engine.
Home, sweet home.
I glanced outside. It wasn't clear to me we'd arrived anywhere. My stomach began churning again, and I couldn't wait for the driver to come around and let me out, although he was obviously in no rush to do anything. I fumbled with the handle, yanking it back and forth before finally realizing it twisted. When I flung the door outward, I went with it, landing on my knees in the gravel.
Maddie!
Ellis cried. I'm all right, I said, still grasping the door handle. I looked up through the strands of hair that had fallen over my face. The clouds shifted to expose the moon, and in its light, I saw our destination. It was a squat, gray building in pebble and dash with heavy black shutters on the windows of both floors. A wooden sign hung over the entrance, creaking in the wind. The Fraser Arms, proprietor A.W. Ross, licensed to serve beer and spirits, good food, rooms, established 1547. My queasiness rose in urgent waves, and while I couldn't believe there was anything left for me to expel, I hauled myself upright and staggered toward a half barrel of frostbitten pansies by the front door. I crashed into the wall instead, hitting first with my open palms and then my left cheek. I stayed there for a moment, my face flattened against the pebbled surface.
Maddie, are you all right?
Ellis asked from somewhere behind me. I'm fine, I said.
You don't look fine.
I turned and slid down the wall, my coat and hair scraping against the embedded stones until I was resting on my heels. Snow collected on my exposed knees. Somewhere in the distance, a sheep bleated.
Maddie?
I'm fine, I said again. I watched as Ellis and Hank climbed out of the car, regarding them with something akin to loathing. Ellis took a few steps toward the building and read the sign. He raised his eyebrows and looked back at Hank.
This is where we're staying.
So it would appear, said Hank.
It looks like a pile of rubble, said Ellis, or one of those long communal mud houses from, you know, Arizona or wherever.
What were you expecting, the Waldorf Astoria? Hank asked. You knew we were going to be roughing it. Think of it as a field camp.
Ellis harumphed.
That would be putting it kindly.
Where's your sense of adventure?
Somewhere in the ship's latrine, I suspect, said Ellis. I suppose Freddy chose this dump.
Of course.
He might as well have sent us to a cave.
Ellis stepped forward and rapped on the door. He waited maybe half a minute, then rapped again. Almost immediately after, he began thumping it with his fist. The door swung open, and Ellis leapt to the side as a huge man in striped blue pajama bottoms and an undershirt burst forth. He was tall, broad, and densely muscled. His black hair stuck up in tufts, his beard was wild, and he was barefoot. He came to a stop, ran his eyes over Ellis and Hank, then peered around them to get a look at the car.
"And what are you wanting at this time of night?" he demanded.
"We need rooms,"
Hank said around the edges of an unlit cigarette. He flicked the top of his lighter open, but before he could get it lit, the man's hand shot forward and snapped it shut.
"You can't smoke outside,"
he said incredulously. After a shocked pause, the man had reached within inches of his face, Hank said.
"Why not?" "The blackout! Are you daft?"
Hank slipped both the lighter and cigarette into his pocket.
"Americans, are you?"
the man continued.
"That we are," said Hank.
"Where is your commanding officer?"
"We're not being billeted. We're private citizens," said Hank.
"In that case, you can take yourselves elsewhere."
The man turned his head to the left and spat. Had he turned to the right, he would have seen me.
"I believe it's all been arranged," Hank said. "Does the name Frederick Stillman ring a bell?"
"Not so much as a tinkle. Get on with you, then. Leave me in peace."
He turned away, clearly planning to leave us on the side of the road. I choked back a sob. If I didn't end up in a bed after everything we'd been through, I didn't think I wanted to survive at all.
"Wait," said Hank quickly.
"You have no rooms?"
"I didn't see that," the man said.
"Do you know what bloody time it is?"
Hank and Ellis exchanged glances.
"Of course," said Ellis. "We're sorry about that. Perhaps we could make it worth your while."
The man grunted.
"Spoken like a tough. I've no truck with the likes of you. Off you go."
He shooed them away with the back of his hand. From just past the car, the driver snorted.
"Please," Ellis said quickly. The journey was rough, and my wife, she's unwell.
The man stopped.
You're what?
He said slowly. Alice inclined his head in my direction. The man turned and saw me crouched against the wall. He studied me for a moment, then looked back at Alice.
You've dragged a woman across the Atlantic during a war, then? Are you completely off your head?
Alice's expression went dark, but he said nothing. The man's eyes flitted briefly skyward. He shook his head.
Fine. You can stay the night, but it's only on account of your wife. And hurry up getting that kit inside, or I'll have the warden around for the blackout. Again. And if I do, I'll not be the one paying the fine, mark my words.
Sure, sure, of course, said Hank. Say, can you do me a favor and send out the porter?
The man responded with a single bark of laughter and went inside.
Huh, said Hank. I guess there's no porter.
And this surprises you because,
said Alice. Hank looked back at the car, whose suspension was significantly lowered by the weight of our belongings. Alice came to me and held out his hands. As he pulled me to my feet, he said,
Go inside, find a seat, and make that brute bring you something to drink. We'll be in as soon as we've got this mess sorted out.
I let myself in. The heavy wooden door groaned in both directions, and when it clicked shut, I glanced around self-consciously. There was no sign of the bearded man, although he'd left a kerosene lamp and a long wooden bar to my left. Glossy beer spigots ran down its length. McEwen's, Younger's, Mackeson, and Guinness, along with a few I couldn't make out. One had a cardboard sign hanging around it, declaring it temporarily unavailable. The lamplight flickered off the bottles and the shelves behind the bar, reflected and amplified by the mirror behind them. It looked for all the world like there was an identical inverted room just beyond, and for a moment I wondered if I was in the wrong one. There were a number of tables and chairs in front of the bar, and a wireless, and a chest-high console against the far wall. The ceiling was low and supported by thick, dark beams, and the floor consisted of huge slabs of stone. The walls were plastered, and even by the dim light of the lamp's flame, I could make out the faint raised edges of the trowel tracks. Thick, black material covered the windows, and it dawned on me that the white-painted lampposts and curbs I'd seen in Alt Bay were to help cars navigate at night during the blackout. To the right was a large stone fireplace with an assortment of stuffed and mismatched furniture arranged in front of it. Victorian, from the looks of it, a couch and two wing chairs positioned across from each other on a threadbare oriental carpet, separated by a low, heavy table. The contents of the grate were covered by an even layer of ash, but still cast a faint orange glow. I made my way to the couch and perched on the very edge of it, holding my numb fingers toward the embers. They smelled like smoked dirt, and the logs stacked off to the side were not wood. I had no idea what they were. They were rectangular and striated, and looked like gigantic Cadbury flake bars, the much-coveted treat sent by the British grandmother of one of my classmates. A dog with scruffy gray fur rose from nowhere, materializing directly beside me. I stiffened. It was enormously tall and thin as a greyhound with the same rounded back and scooped abdomen. It stared at me, its dark eyes mournful, its tail curled between its legs.
Don't worry. He'll do you no harm.
The bearded man had come through a doorway behind the bar. He picked up the lamp, crossed the room, and set a glass of something fizzy on the table in front of me. The low ceiling accentuated his height, but he would have been imposing in any circumstances. His eyes were an unlikely and startling blue under eyebrows as unruly as his beard. He remained barefoot and robeless, and apparently unbothered by it.
You've had a rough journey, then?
Yes. I reached up instinctively to check my hair, although since I could see myself from the chest down, I had a fair idea of how I looked. He nodded at the glass.
Ginger beer, to settle your stomach.
Thank you, I said. That's very kind. I felt his eyes upon me. After a beat of silence, he said,
I suppose you've heard there's a war.
A familiar bristle ran up the back of my neck. I turned to see if Ellis was within earshot, but he and Hank were still outside, beyond the closed door, having a heated discussion with the driver. I have, yes.
Your husband and his friend look able-bodied enough.
My husband and his colleague are here to perform scientific research, I said. The man threw his head back and laughed.
Of course. Monster hunters. Absolutely brilliant. And here I was thinking you were war tourists.
He set the lamp on the table and waved at a board of keys behind the bar.
You can take 2 and 3, or 4 and 5, or 2 and 6 for that matter. It makes no difference to me. And be quick about it. I'll not have you wasting my paraffin.
I was emboldened. I'd never met a man so rude. Surely you mean kerosene, I said.
I think I know what I mean,
he said, turning to leave. Wait, I said quickly. Don't you want to know our names?
Not particularly. What I want is to be in bed.
He slapped his thigh.
Colonel, pick a show.
The dog went to his side, and they slipped into the shadows behind the bar. I was still staring at the place they'd disappeared when Hank and Alice lurched through the front door, carrying a trunk between them. They dropped it on the worn flagstones and looked around.
Where's the light switch?
Alice said, squinting as he searched the walls. I don't think there is one, I said. I watched Alice's eyes as he scanned the various lamps and sconces around the room. They were all topped by glass globes, oil lamps, every one.
Are you kidding me? There's no electricity.
I don't think so, I said. His eyes glommed onto the radio.
What about that?
Maybe it runs on batteries. I don't know, I said. Isn't the driver going to help you with the luggage?
He took off, said Hank. Left everything in the driveway.
You could have just tipped him again, Alice said.
I believe it was your turn, Hank said.
Alice glared at him.
What? It's only money, Hank said. Anyway, it doesn't matter now. He's gone, and we need help. Where's that charming Scotsman?
I'm pretty sure he went back to bed, I said.
But we need help. Did you see where he went? Said Hank, craning his neck.
His eyes lit on the doorway behind the bar. Hank, please, just leave him alone. Chapter 7
Good Lord, Maddie, what did you pack? I told you to bring stockings, not gold bullion, said Hank,
dragging one of my suitcases behind him and letting it bang against each step. Just some essentials, I said. I was at the top of the stairwell, holding the lamp as Hank and Ellis brought up our luggage. I was freezing and queasy, and the lamp swung accordingly. I was terrified I'd trip and set the carpet on fire.
Along with anchors and anvils, apparently, said Hank,
dropping the suitcase and wiping his hands. Ellis came up behind him with 2 hatboxes.
That's everything, he said. Not really, said Hank. We still have to get it into the rooms. I don't know why Maddie wouldn't just let me rouse Paul Bunyan.
She doesn't like to discomfort the staff, said Alice.
Why ever not? Asked Hank, looking at me with surprise.
Isn't that what staff is for? Well, I would say so, yes, said Alice.
It's still not too late to get him, you know, said Hank.
Yes, it is, I said crossly. He said we could take any of rooms 2 through 6, so can we please just do that and go to bed?
All right, darling girl, said Hank, glancing up the row of doors. I was merely pointing out that it would be faster if we had help. No need to work up a lather.
I wobbled toward a hall table so I could ditch the lamp. I was as dizzy as the moment I'd gotten off the ship. If I hadn't known it was impossible, I'd have sworn the building itself was swaying.
Why do you suppose room 1 is off limits? Said Hank.
I turned around to find him trying the locked door.
Hank, stop! For heaven's sake! Somebody's probably asleep in there, and every other room is available.
He continued to jiggle the knob.
But what if this is the room I want? What if it's the only one with a decent bath?
The door swung inward, tearing the knob from Hank's hand. He took a long step backward as a striking young woman with red hair burst into the hallway, wielding a fire iron.
And what the hell are you wanting? She shouted in a thick accent.
Her hair was tied into curls with scraps of cloth, and she was wearing a heavy white nightgown. She planted herself in front of Hank, grasping the poker with both hands.
Henry Winston Boyd,
Hank replied, without missing a beat. He held out his hand.
The 4th. And you?
She turned her head and bellowed down the hall.
Angus! Angus!
Hank took a step backward, hands up in surrender.
No, wait. We're fellow guests. We've just arrived. See?
He gestured toward our luggage, which was scattered up and down the hallway. She assessed it, ran her eyes over Ellis and me, and finally settled back on Hank. She stepped right up to him, brandishing the iron in his face.
"I am no guest," she said, slanting her eyes accusingly. "I'm Meg, and I'm not on the clock until tomorrow evening, so I'll not be doing anything for you until then, and that goes for all of you."
She returned to her room and slammed the door. After a beat of silence, Hank said,
"I think she likes me."
"Just pick a room," said Alice.
"No, really, I think she does."
The rooms were cramped and depressing. Each had a dresser with a mirror hanging above it, a narrow bed with two nightstands, and beyond that, a small sitting area with a lumpy chair, fireplace, and a single blacked-out window. The wallpaper was faded Victorian, the rugs threadbare. Hank chose room 2, while Ellis and I took 5 and 6, respectively. Although Hank didn't spell out why he'd chosen that particular room, it wasn't hard to figure out. Despite everything we'd just been through, he was plotting a romantic conquest. I was already incensed on Violet's behalf. I was pretty sure Hank never had told her we were leaving, but at that moment I was close to outrage. Then it occurred to me that maybe Hank didn't think a dalliance with Meg would count as an infidelity. Perhaps he simply felt entitled that he had the droit du seigneur over servants. Various rumors followed Hank around, including one about a pregnant kitchen maid his mother had tried, unsuccessfully, to frame for stealing, and who disappeared shortly thereafter, presumably with a large sum of money. The highlight of the story had always been how Hank's mother had stashed an entire set of Georgian silver in the girl's room and then called the police. The actual cause of the situation was glossed over, dismissed, with the vague explanation that boys will be boys. In the narrative, the maid herself never quite seemed real to me, nor did the child. I wondered now if either ever crossed Hank's mind. "I'm going to lie down," I said, leaving the men to deal with the luggage. My room was the final one on the left. I lit the candle on the dresser and fell on the bed, shoes and all, waiting for them to bring in my things.
"The door at the end we thought was a closet," said Hank, dragging in a trunk. "It's a bathroom, thank God." "Shared," came Ellis's voice from the hallway.
"With running water," Hank called back.
He looked at me and winked.
"Wait for it," he whispered, holding a finger to his lips. "Wait any second now."
Out in the hallway, Ellis mumbled something inaudible. Hank laughed uproariously.
"He always gets the last word, or so he thinks. Anyway, the bathroom. It's indoors, and it's right next to you, you lucky thing."
As much as I felt like collapsing, I had to at least get the soot off my face and scour my teeth. I revived myself enough to dig through my luggage and find what I needed. No easy task, since I'd undone all of Emily's good work in my panic to consolidate for the trip. We'd been warned that our storage space on the freighter was limited, an irony if I'd ever heard one, since the ship's raison d'être was storage. In the end, I'd found myself throwing things in randomly, frantically, sure that whatever I didn't bring would turn out to be vitally important. As I left my room, I banged into the corner of the dresser so hard I cried out, and a horrible thought struck me. What if the waves never did stop? What if I was going to be like that forever? When I returned from the bathroom, Ellis was at the far end of my room, poking the empty grate with a fire iron.
"Empty, of course, and the radiators are off. A class act all around. No electricity, one bathroom, no heat. I'm going to get some wood, or coal, or dung, or whatever it is they're burning downstairs."
"Please don't," I said. "The fellow who let us in seems sensitive about fuel."
"So what? I can see my breath."
He presented his profile and exhaled, loosing a gossamer wisp of vapor. "I'll be fine," I said. "There are lots of blankets, and I can always wear my robe to bed."
"Are you sure? I don't mind dealing with Blackbeard."
"Yes, I'm sure. Anyway, we'd probably burn the place down." Ellis cracked a slow smile.
"You mean like Hamlet House?"
During our honeymoon in Key West, an unattended cigar of Ellis's had nearly caused a catastrophe at an historic painted lady we'd nicknamed Hamlet House, because the Prince of Denmark was a fellow guest. The Prince, along with everyone else, was forced to change hotels, but since no one was hurt, the incident became funny in the retelling, a part of Ellis's and my shared repertoire, a story we trotted out at parties. I knew that by bringing it up, He was trying to stir a fond memory and make things better between us. But what he didn't realize was that remembering the fire in Key West just made me think of the horribly burned man I'd seen carried off the ship only a few hours earlier. "Yes, like Hamlet House," I said.
"We didn't burn it down, merely scorched a few rooms," he said whimsically.
I climbed into bed and shuddered. Alice furrowed his brow, then set the poker in its stand and came to my side. We'd made a fragile peace after finally outrunning the U-boats, a truce that consisted mostly of giving each other as much space as possible in a situation where there simply wasn't any, and talking only when absolutely necessary. But that didn't mean my breakdown on the ship hadn't happened, or that I wasn't aware of how horrifyingly quickly proximity had bred contempt, or that I wasn't still terrified and furious about being dragged along on this half-baked escapade. It was the stupidest and most dangerous thing we'd ever done. It was also pointless. I'd realized it the moment the driver commented on the lifebelt that remained around Ellis's waist, and again when the bearded man asked why he and Hank weren't serving, and I knew that it would keep happening. The very thing we tried to escape had followed us across the Atlantic. I opened my eyes and found Ellis staring down at me, his misery obvious. I knew he wanted comfort, a sign that things would go back to normal between us, but I couldn't give it to him. I just couldn't. "Please, Ellis, I don't mean to be harsh, but I'm completely and absolutely desperate for sleep." His lips stretched into a sad line.
"Of course. I know you're exhausted."
He leaned over to kiss my forehead, and in that instant, my resentment shattered, leaving behind an awful, piercing regret. No one had put a gun to my head and forced me to board the ship. I bore as much blame for my predicament as anyone else. He and Hank may have told me that nothing would happen to us, but I was the one who'd chosen to believe them. "Ellis," I said as he turned to go, "I'm sorry."
"About what?" he asked, stopping.
"The things," I said. He laughed quietly.
"Which ones?"
"All of them. I was just so frightened." He came back and sat on the edge of the bed.
"No need to apologize. I just hadn't realized I was married to quite such a firecracker."
He laid a hand on my cheek, and my eyes welled up. I hoped I was wrong about how people over here would perceive him, but if I was not, I hoped I could somehow protect him from their judgment, make him unaware, or better yet, not care. "I wasn't myself," I said.
"None of us was, my darling."
"Except Hank," I said, sniffling. "Hank was himself the entire time."
"Ah, yes. Dear old Hank. Ever the pill," he said, getting up. "Speaking of which, do you think you need one?"
"No, I'm all right." That was my cue to offer him one, and I would have, except that I had no idea where they were and didn't have the energy to look.
"Sleep tight, my darling. Tomorrow, Hank and I will find a decent hotel, and then all you'll have to worry about is regaining your strength."
He picked up the candle and went to the door. I rolled to face him. "Ellis," I said as he stepped into the hallway, "this feeling of still being at sea, do you think it's normal?" He paused before answering.
"Perfectly," he said. "It will be gone in the morning. You'll see."
He closed the door. As I lay in bed, I could no more stop the waves than escape the images and sounds of the wounded being marched down the gangplank, one after the other, in a seemingly endless line. Chapter 8. I woke up to the sound of a blood-curdling scream, and it was a few seconds before I realized it was coming from my own throat. My eyes sprang open, but it made no difference. None. The black was impenetrable, the pitching violent. The engine wasn't running. Why wasn't the engine running? Even if the whooshing in my head had been shrill enough to drown out the sound of the turbines, nothing would have been able to disguise the vibration. The thrum had been relentless, rattling brains, teeth, and eardrums, just like the propellers of a plane, and its absence was terrifying. I'd been dreaming that the SS Mallory took a direct hit, but now I realized it wasn't a dream. The cabin rocked madly, almost as though the freighter was turning, rotating like a corkscrew as it slid below the surface. "Ellis!" I cried out. "Ellis!"
I felt the blanket on either side of me, but he wasn't there, which meant he was lying injured somewhere on the floor, thrown on impact. I had to find him fast, because the cabinet tilted so drastically, I wasn't sure how much longer I'd be able to find the door. I slapped the surface and edges of the bunk, hoping to identify which direction I was facing, and hoping Hank was trying to find his way to us as well, because I didn't think I could drag Ellis out on my own. When my hands hit a wooden headboard, I was momentarily confused. When I found a bedside table with a lace runner, I fell onto my back, gasping with relief. I wasn't on the SS Mallory. I was in a bed in a hotel room in Drumna Drochet, and the motion was all in my head. I reached over and felt my way across the bedside table, seeking the candle, before remembering that Ellis had taken it with him the night before. I got to my feet, thinking that if I could just find the dresser, I could then find the door. I had taken only a couple of steps when my foot landed on something and twisted out from under me. I fell on my hands and knees. The door opened, and a female figure was suddenly in the doorway, with light pouring in around her.
"Mrs. Pennypacker, is everything all right?" she asked.
I blinked at her, wondering why she just addressed me by my mother's name.
"My lord!"
She rushed over to help me up.
"What's happened? Are you all right?"
"Yes, thank you," I said. I seemed to have tripped over a shoe, of all things. Now that the light was no longer behind her, I could see that she was about my age, with a sturdy frame, pleasant expression, and thick auburn hair swept into a snood. She had a smattering of freckles, and her face was browned by the sun.
"Shall I get your husband?"
she asked, looking at me with concern.
"No, thank you," I said.
"I just need a minute to get oriented. When I woke up, I wasn't quite sure where I was, and then..." I waved a hand at the carpet, which was strewn with the things I'd taken out while searching for my nightgown and toothbrush. "Well, I was in a bit of a rush to get to bed last night, and this morning I couldn't see where I was going."
"It's the blackout curtains," she said,
nodding decisively and walking past to the window.
"They are that dark you can't see a thing, although I suppose that's the point."
She braced her fingertips on the inside edges of the window casing and coaxed out a solid square frame covered with black material. Light flooded the room.
"That's better, isn't it?" she said,
setting the frame on the floor. Strips of tape crisscrossed the panes of glass. After a second's confusion, I realized they were in case of a bomb blast.
"Yes, thank you," I said,
trying to suppress my alarm.
"Is that a wooden frame? I've always thought blackout curtains were actual curtains." "Aye, we use traditional curtains too, but then you have to pin the cloth all the way around so no light can get past. This contraption is much easier on the fingers. Angus made them after the last time we got fined. 12 shillings it was, all because old Donnie had the temerity to push the curtain aside for a wee moment to see if it was still raining. And the warden is a wee free, and he's not from the Glen, so there was no getting around that, I can tell you. 12 shillings, that's more than a day's wages for a shopkeeper," she said indignantly,
catching my eye to make sure I understood. I nodded emphatically.
"Now these," she continued, "you could put the sun itself right behind them, and not one ree would get through. Angus stretched the material tight and then painted the whole thing with black epoxy rubber."
She leaned over to tap its surface.
"That's like a drum, that is."
"Is Angus the one with the beard?"
"Aye."
"And he's the handyman?" She laughed.
"I should think not. He runs the place."
A.W. Ross. It made perfect sense, but hadn't even occurred to me, an assumption based entirely on appearance. I caught sight of myself in the mirror and felt ridiculous for judging. I looked like I'd been dragged backward through a hedge. The ceiling began spinning again, and I dropped onto the edge of the bed.
"You've gone pale as a potato crust," said the girl, coming closer to inspect me. "Shall I bring up some tea?"
"No, I'll be fine. I'm still a bit dizzy from the ship, strangely enough," I said.
"Aye,"
she said, nodding gravely.
"I've heard of that, people getting stuck like that."
A jolt of fear ran through me, even as I ranged my face into a smile. "Don't worry," I said. "My husband and I sail all the time. I probably just have a bit of a cold. You know, an ear thing. It will pass. Speaking of my husband, is he up yet?"
"He's been downstairs this half hour."
"Will you please let him know I'll be down in a few minutes? I need a moment to pull myself together."
She glanced at my luggage.
Well, with this lot, that shouldn't be hard. I should think you could start your own shop if you wanted to. If you change your mind about having your tea upstairs, just give me a shout.
I'm sorry, what's your name again? I asked, knowing perfectly well she hadn't yet told me.